Abe
yes,
Beeson.
Gabe.
KPLU colleague and friend. Have you ever had anything stolen from you?
Yes, I have been a victim of theft. Yeah, not a good feeling.
Did it have anything to do with this by any chance?
The ultimate goal has been and continues to be to preserve the future of professional basketball here in the Northwest region, and to do it in a way that I think reaffirms our commitment to our fans.
Commitment to the fans, Gabe.
Do you want to explain what's going on in that
Yeah,
audio?
That's the former owner of the Seattle Supersonics talking about the commitment to the fans by keeping the Seattle Supersonics in town. Sounds like a great idea. I'd go with that.
Well, that piece of tape came from the 2009 documentary Sonicsgate: Requiem for a Team, chronicling what many would consider a great theft. Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer at Sound Effect, and today for the show, we're thinking about theft. And a lot of fans did feel robbed when the Sonics took off in 2008. How did you feel?
Hopelessness when for your whole life, you really did feel like you're a part of the team. I am especially remembering the great mid-90s run, which is 10 years ago that season began, where Gary Payton, Sean Kemp, and Detlef, and Big Smooth, and Hersey Hawkins, and Mac 10 that took us all the way to the championship against the Bulls.
Let the celebration begin in Seattle. It is over. The Seattle Supersonics have won the NBA World Championship Series in five games.
And then you realize that, no, you're not part of that. It's 31 guys who own these teams and the league that arranges them, and they'll do whatever they want to do. You want to kind of be more logical about it, but you know, all those feelings from your childhood about, you know, sitting in the sailboat with your dad and your brother trying to see how many Sonics players you can name, all that is going to go away.
How long did it take you to get over that, Abe?
Still not over it, Gabe.
And how does that play out in your life?
Oh, geez. Well, every once in a while, and it's more and more often, pleasantly so, I'll see somebody with a Sonics hat on or a Sonics shirt on or maybe some Sonics shoes. And it gives me that feeling of community still, but there's a real sad element to that.
Well, it's interesting because like your office is lined with Sonics memorabilia.
Yeah, indeed. And that's something I do every morning when I get to work. I open up the blinds in my office because I'm right on the street. I want everybody to see those posters because I want people to remember that that's part of our city.
Hey, were the Sonics really stolen? Was this a theft? I mean, this was a business transaction, right?
Yeah. There's nothing illegal about it. Something was taken from this team, but you just get that feeling like the thief is in the house taking your stuff and you know they're going to get away with it. There's nothing you can do.
Now, since then, there have been a few efforts to get a team for Seattle, and those efforts have focused primarily on other teams in other cities. How do you feel about the potential that Seattle could steal somebody else's team?
You're exactly right, Gabe. And it came really close with the Sacramento Kings, and I don't want that to happen. I'll wait as long as it takes to get an expansion team. I don't want to do that to another fan.
You would turn down a team from another city.
It's easier to not be a fan than to do that to somebody else.
Well, Abe Beeson, jazz host at KPLU and owner of a saucer-sized Sonics tattoo, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. And remember what Kevin Calabro said. Your Seattle Supersonics.
Well, we have more tales of theft just ahead on Sound Effects, so don't go away. Today, we're going to be hearing from people who have had all sorts of things taken from them, things like bikes and wallets, but also big things like history or cultural identity. But our first story is a classic kind of theft, though it's got a twist. It's about a bank robber. And bank robbery might make you think of Westerns or old heist movies, and it is easy to romanticize it. And that is exactly what Sean Hopwood did.
Oh no, it was kind of romantic. And I had kind of glamorized it because at the time I was a very immature young man, and young men that are foolish tend to glamorize the wrong things. And so that played, I wouldn't say a large role, but it played a role in being able to say yes to something that I should have very quickly said no to.
Sean didn't say no. In fact, Sean would go on to rob 5 banks. The idea came up as a half joke with a friend, but then they didn't drop it. Now, this is no excuse, but Sean's life was not going too well at the time. He wasn't working. He was crashing with friends, and he'd been honorably discharged from the Navy, and he was struggling with drugs and depression. So he and his friend made a plan, and then one day, Sean found himself carrying it out.
When I walked into those banks, everything in my body told me to leave and get out of there and not do it. I just remember that we went in and we tried to get in and out of there as fast as we possibly could. I'm talking like 2 or 3 minutes. And I remember that the first bank robbery, a lady came in the middle of it. And, you know, she was very scared. And I remember, you know, telling her that everything was going to be all right and we were going to be out of there very soon.
Did you hand him a note? Did you demand it?
So I had walked in first, and I had a toolbox with bags inside the toolbox that my partner was going to get the bags out and put the money in the bags. So I dropped the toolbox, and when I dropped it, everybody in the bank turned and looked at me, and I yelled, "This is a robbery," and that's when my friend came in.
This is a robbery. Had you rehearsed that?
No. I mean, what else are you supposed to say? That sounds pretty lame, but, yeah.
Robbing banks changed Sean's life, but not only in the ways that you'd expect. By the time I talked to him, Sean Hopwood had become a successful lawyer. He'd had petitions accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court even before he went to law school at the University of Washington. And we're going to get to all that, but first, let's hear what happened when they left that first bank.
We actually dropped the stolen car off and jumped into a grain truck that my partner's family owned. And we had a handheld scanner, and I could hear the police say, "Well, we think we've got him." And I thought we were getting pulled over and this was it, that they had us. Did not realize that they had pulled over 2 18-year-old boys on the highway and thought that they had robbed the bank, and that's who they were talking about, not us.
So for all you knew, the fuzz was right outside.
Yeah, so I thought they were right behind us, and this was it. And that was, we were both going to prison right then and there.
How did you think about the possibility of getting caught? Was it something that you imagined or envisioned?
Yes, I always knew we were going to get caught.
You knew?
Yes. Especially the more that we did. I mean, I knew it was only a matter of time. This will kind of fill you in on the desperation I felt at the time. My hope was that, you know, when they came to arrest me, they would just shoot me and that would be the end of it. But I was never under any illusion that we were going to get away with this.
So you want to tell the story of how you did get caught?
I was headed to a hotel room to go pick up my brother, and I walked in and I went to the hotel room and knocked on the door, and there was no answer. I walked back through the lobby and didn't really pay much attention to the fact that there were 5 guys sitting in suits. They got up and tackled me. And I was in handcuffs before I knew it. And that's when I realized that the FBI had just arrested me.
So what was that like as it kind of dawned on you? Like, wow, this doesn't just end with me, my life ending. This ends with me having to go to court and figure out how I'm going to plead and go to prison and live life in prison. Like, how did that sort of dawn on you?
When it really hit me was when my parents came to visit me and my mom was crying and realizing the aftermath and all of the pain I had caused, not only to family members, but to friends, to the people that were in those banks, to people in my community. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. There are still days I wake up and I think about what I did and how I hurt the people that were close to me.
And did you have that thought that, you know, I'm going straight, I'm going to fix my life and make up for what I did? Did that thought pop in your head?
Not at that time, no. It's just really hard to get up and say, I need to make changes when you're facing a 10, 20, 30-year prison sentence. Because there's not much hope, and you really have to have some hope to be able to make those sorts of changes. And it wasn't until, you know, a couple of years into my sentence when I found the law and started finding a purpose in life, that things really began to change for me.
The way you just described, you know, finding the law and finding your purpose, I mean, it sounds like finding religion almost. Was it a religious type experience for you?
Well, it was the first thing I had done academically that I was good at and that I was successful at. And, you know, when you find something you're good at, more times than not, you become passionate about it. And then what I found out was not only could I be good at it, but I could actually help other people. And I really was drawn towards that, the part of helping others. And so that's kind of what sucked me in. I wouldn't say it was a religious experience. It was just an awakening.
What is it in you that emerged in that way?
I know that I don't mind a good argument. prison is a good place to prepare one for lots of confrontation. And so that doesn't scare me either, which two very good traits to have as a lawyer. And I found it intellectually challenging in a way that I had not any other subject in school previously.
So there's a long and well-worn tradition of jailhouse lawyers in this country. What was the kind of culture of that like in the places where you were incarcerated? Was there a certain cast of people who were the jailhouse lawyers, and how did people treat them?
There were, but it was a rather diverse group. Older, younger, black, white, Hispanic. There were all different types of jailhouse lawyers. That gave me a certain status. Not at first so much because, you know, there are lots of jailhouse lawyers in prison. There are very few jailhouse lawyers that actually have success. To do what I did, which was get the Supreme Court to grant a case, it's about a 1% chance. And so these aren't things that happen very often. And the more success I had, the greater my status became in prison.
We will hear more from Sean Hopwood, including about his big career break, after we take our own little break. Don't go away. Okay, so if you missed part one of Sean Hopwood's story, let me catch you up. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Our theme this week is theft, and Sean Hopwood was a thief. He robbed 5 banks in Nebraska in his early 20s, and he went to federal prison to serve more than 10 years. And at this point in the story, that's where he is. He'd carved out a place for himself in prison, doing something that surprised a lot of people, including himself, being a really successful jailhouse lawyer.
Well, so I had gone from looking at my own case and filing a brief on my own behalf to writing memos for the other prisoners' lawyers suggesting claims that could be raised on appeal to actually then writing briefs for prisoners. And the second or third brief I prepared was for a man named John Fellers. He was in on a conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine and had a 12-year sentence and was recently denied in the Court of Appeals. And he came to me and said, "Listen, Sean, the Court of Appeals denied my appeal. I just got off the phone with my lawyer. He said we have no chance in the Supreme Court. And so I really have nobody to do the Supreme Court petition. Would you do it?" And I knew that I didn't know very much about the Supreme Court and that it was going to be quite the undertaking to try and get this petition for certiorari, is what it's called, filed to the U.S. Supreme Court within a 2-month period. But John was persuasive, and we filed his brief, and John was transferred to another prison, and I largely forgot about John Fellers and his case till one morning I was walking out to the recreation yard to go work out, and a friend of mine came running and screaming. My first thought was, what did I say to him yesterday that he wants to come fight me at 6:30 in the morning? What I didn't realize was he had a newspaper in his hand, and it was a copy of the USA Today, and it was the first time I had seen my words cited anywhere, let alone in a major newspaper, national newspaper.
So you end up serving a little over 10 years in federal prison, doing legal work all along. And when you got out, you got your undergraduate degree, which you hadn't had at the beginning. And you wound up getting a pretty prestigious scholarship through the Gates Foundation to the University of Washington School of Law. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what life was like in law school.
It's always strange when you walk into a place with hundreds of people or even, you know, 10 or 20 people, and everyone knows your life story and you know none of theirs. I was also a lot older than most of my classmates by at least a decade. But on the whole, people at the University of Washington treated me wonderfully.
Now you just completed a clerkship on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is generally thought to be the second most prominent court in the United States below the Supreme Court. And you're about to take a faculty position at Georgetown University School of Law. And so you're mixing with a lot of fancy lawyers, I'm guessing. And what's that like to have them know, or if they don't know, what's it like to tell them?
Oh, it's can be hilarious sometimes when you're at some reception and someone asks, well, what are you doing? And I say, going to work at Georgetown at the appellate clinic. And why appellate law? And I say, well, I kind of did appellate law for 10 years before law school, which always prompts the question, well, how did you do appellate practice before law school? Because there is this thing called the illegal practice of law out in the real world. You know, I get various degrees of reception when I tell them the story. Everything from wow to gaping mouths wide open to congratulations.
And has this made you think any differently about what the law is for? Is the law a set of, you know, moral instructions that we are obligated as members of society to follow? Is it something that's just supposed to protect us? Is it just a framework that we kind of build around us to protect us from other people? You know, what's the law supposed to do?
I think where my background has impacted me the most is maybe not, I don't hold the same reverence for the legal profession that other law school students might, in that I've seen a lot of really bad lawyers. And while I know the legal profession can be quite noble, and it oftentimes is, there's just as many times where lawyers and the law have committed grave injustices that we need to fix.
Sean, how much connection do you feel like you have still to the guy you were when you robbed those banks in your early 20s?
Not only do I no longer even consider myself the same person that robbed those banks, but it also feels like it was someone else that did those 10 years in prison. I mean, life is so different for me now. But, you know, I can tell you that I'm not the only one that goes through life and makes huge life-altering changes from 20 to what I am now is 40. If everyone goes through those changes, then why do we believe that prisoners can't change for the better and that they aren't redeemable too? Because I think most of them are.
What I'm wondering about, I guess, is that because I'm almost the same age as you, and I feel like a very different person than I was when I was 20, 22 also. But once in a while, there's a little moment where I get a feeling or a memory or something that puts me right back in those shoes. And I'm wondering if that happens to you.
There are times where I go back to prison pretty quickly. There was one morning I was walking through the courthouse of the D.C. Circuit, and a marshal was walking by, and they must have been bringing people in that were going to be sentenced that day, because he had a handful of shackles, chains worn on your legs when you're a prisoner, to be transferred in between buildings. And I heard the rattling of those chains, and before I even saw him, it just ran a shiver up my spine, because I remember vividly having handcuffs and shackles and a belly chain. And here I am walking through this courthouse in a suit, and just that one little noise takes me back instantly.
Well, Sean Hopwood has come a long way. He is about to start teaching in the Appellate Law Clinic at Georgetown University School of Law, and he clerked for the D.C. Circuit Court. He's a UW School of Law grad, but all that came after more than 10 years in federal prison for bank robbery. And he joined us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Sean, for talking to us on Sound Effect.
Thank you very much for having me. Go Huskies.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. We're thinking today about theft, and just about all of us have had something stolen at some point. You know, maybe your house was broken into, or your wallet was swiped, or they broke into your 1993 Honda Accord and stole your fleece and your shoebox of cassette tapes. Anyway, maybe it was something that wasn't physical. You know, it could have been an idea or a love. Well, whatever it was, most of us know that sick feeling that you get when you first discover something that's supposed to be there is suddenly gone. KPLU's Jennifer Wing went out and she gathered some personal tales of theft from around Seattle.
I asked people, have you experienced theft? And if so, what was taken from you? They didn't have a lot of time to come up with an answer. Lots of people had to think pretty hard, and most said they were lucky. Nothing was ever taken from them. They insisted, really, nothing. The people who did feel something was unfairly removed from their lives didn't hesitate to respond.
The major things that have been stolen from me have been my humor that my friends have taken and co-opted and use that humor as their own like sense of humor, which always kind of like made me proud and angry at the same time. So
people have stolen your humor.
They have. My jokes, my humor, and my bike has been stolen. My son just told me that.
2 months ago, someone stole my car. In front of my house.
Did you lock it?
No, I didn't. That's why. Yes, exactly. I didn't lock it. Because I know everything is quiet, but now that someone stole my car, I have to lock it and I double check all the doors before I go home.
So maybe they stole a little bit of your trust, too.
Yes, they did.
My bag was stolen, yes. All I lost were a couple of invaluable and irreplaceable poems. So he received nothing of value to him, and I lost that which was invaluable to me. They are rare and irreplaceable. It cannot be rewritten. It doesn't work that way.
I worked for the federal government in Washington, D.C., and one day I went to a congressman's office, and I had to go run an errand for my boss. I left my purse sitting on the couch in the congressman's office because I thought it was safe. And I was gone 1 or 2 minutes, not long, came back, it was gone. But it wasn't the congressman that stole it. And after that, what I realized, no, there's no place that's safe. If you care about what you have, then you need to take care of it and make sure that it's with you.
So I had this really cool toy, and then I walk away for 2 minutes to just grab a drink of water, and then when I come back, it's gone, and all I can find is a note that says L. That's it.
I have a tattoo on my hand of Washington State with 206 inside of it. And that idea has been stolen. Somebody's trying to make t-shirts with it. And I told them I wanted to do that, you know. And then to see them later on printing out t-shirts. But I don't think they've like printed out like thousands of them. I just seen like a couple of them made, and it's really made me upset, you know. And I, you know, that's my idea. I created that, you know, to have it stolen from me is, yeah, it sucks.
Boyfriend. Boyfriend was stolen away from me. I was devastated. And we live in a kind of a dorm, so I have to face this person every day. It was quite a struggle. So I curled into myself like a snail, you know, and just put on a happy face as though nothing happened. But I really felt pain, sadness and sorrow inside. I've never, ever forgotten that. The sadness, the shame, the jealousy, oh, a whole charisma of things.
I've had a bike stolen, which made me really mad at myself because I didn't put it away. I left it out in the front yard. It was a preventable loss. The most annoying theft was when my laundry would routinely disappear from the dryer in my old apartment building in Bellingham. So what about the other side? What about stealing? After people shared what they've had taken from them, I asked them, what did you steal?
Well, I usually steal some pen in my office. Yeah, but that's all.
You steal pens in your office.
Yes, I do.
I grew up in a strange place, and I did shoplift for social status.
I was 4 years old, and I lived on an Air Force base in California. And I'd been over at a friend's house playing, and it was time for me to go home. And so I was walking from where my friend lived to my own house, and there was a little red wagon, and in the little red wagon was a golden book about howdy doody. And the little golden book looked at me and it said, take me. So I said, okay. Looked around, nobody there, so I took it. I never got found out. I got to keep howdy doody, and I've always wondered who was the kid that I stole howdy doody from, but I enjoyed the book a great deal.
No, I stole a bike before.
I stole one of my sister's candies, a Jolly Rancher.
I was really young, and I was riding with somebody. They got pulled over. It was like my auntie's boyfriend. He ended up going to jail, and then I ended up staying with these people, and I wanted to get home, you know, and it was late, and I wasn't going to stay at their house, so I just started walking. Halfway home, got a bike.
You stole a little girl's bike.
Yeah, it was bad, but I don't think that was like her, you know, brand new bike. There was nice other bikes, and I just took the smallest, ugliest one, and it worked, and it got me home.
Gerald Bear, who took that bike when he was 14, says he has since redeemed himself by giving away several of the bikes he's owned. We also heard from Mike Casasa, Patrick McCabe, Farida Abdullah, Lucian Lindsay, Beverly Aka, and Jacqueline Duran. And what have I stolen? No, I'm not telling.
KPLU's Jennifer Wing. You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We've been hearing stories of theft today. Some of them are petty thefts, but this story is about the theft of something huge. It's about how generations of young people were robbed of their language and their culture and their history. And this happened at a series of boarding schools designed to educate and assimilate Native American students. At these schools, these kids were forbidden from expressing their Indian identities. The founder of some of the most infamous boarding schools coined this phrase for what he was trying to do: kill the Indian in him to save the man. Those schools were in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Russell Jim is a member of the Yakima tribe, and as a child, his father was taken to Carlisle. Then in the 1940s, Jim himself was taken to a boarding school in Oregon. Here's his story.
My name is Russell Jim. I'm the project director of the Environmental Restoration Waste Management Program for the Yakima Nation. My father, because of many things, World War I included, he got sick easy. He blames it on gas over there for his hair turning prematurely white. When I was 3 months old, my dad took me to his sister and said, I can't raise him, I can't feed him. She raised me. One day, I saw a little suitcase. I saw some great looking pants in there, some great looking homemade shirts. I said, what's the occasion? And that was when the K came and said, it's your turn to go. And I didn't really know what they meant. I was only 5 years old at the time. Down here in Toppenish, Washington, they had a Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's where they took me and loaded me on the bus. And my aunt was standing right outside there looking at me. Whenever I wanted anything, anything at all I had to do was let big tears run down and she'd go get it for me. And I realized that I was leaving for some reason or other, and I started to cry. She looked at me for a bit and turned and walked away. My first witness at the power of the white man. They took me to Chemawa, that place in Oregon. Eventually, you know, a Sunday came around, the first Sunday I was there, and they took me to a room with rows and rows and rows of white shirts. They found two white shirts that fit me, wrote my name inside the collar. They said, each Sunday you come here and you get this white shirt, put it on, go to their Lutheran church, listen to the angels coming in every morning singing the song, you know. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. And as I found out later on, it was not an education institute, it was an assimilation institute. They tried to discipline everybody whenever they'd find us speaking our language. They'd beat us, they'd spank us, spank our hands, tell us, no, 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 bad, bad. They did that to my sister so bad that eventually throughout the rest of her life, she could understand every word of Indian I spoke. We spoke to her, but she couldn't repeat one sentence without going into a trauma. That's how bad they beat her. There was two little guys my age. We found out we could understand Yakima. So we'd sneak around, speak to each other in whispers. We found a loose board one time, and three of us would periodically go sneak under there among all the dust and all that, sit there and speak our language to each other. We'd giggle knowing it was illegal according to the non-Indians, but then we'd also cry because we'd get lonesome. And the punishments were morally made to shame us, belittle you. You wet the bed and they wash your face in front of everybody with that damp sheet. Then Saturday morning, we had to run the gauntlet, which means everybody got to line the hallway. The guy with the most demerits had to run down that hallway and everybody gets to have their belt take a swipe at him. And even at 5 years old, I used to realize, you know, why am I doing this? And it's a way to teach you how to punish your own. There are so many things that went on there that when I finally came home and I relayed this to my aunt that raised me, she went to my father and said, you can send the rest of your children to that school if you want to. This one's not going. If you don't want to do that, take him to the hills and you'll never find us. She could have did it too. So he took me down to the nearest school within a mile of where we lived. The public school, Garfield School here in Toppenish. And he was told, oh, we don't allow Indians in this school. So he went to the Veterans of Foreign Wars and American Legion, and the next day they all marched down there and said, you don't allow this boy in the school, we're gonna sue you and shut you down. So they let me in. Then I had to whip every boy in that class. They didn't like Indians. Today, the younger generation is not speaking the language like they should be. I think part of it is because in places like Chamawa, psychologically that was put in the minds of your grandparents. That mindset is passed down through the generations. Many who didn't want to be embarrassed by being Indian assimilated. Many of the half-breeds who look like you, they wouldn't admit there were any Indian. Most of them today don't understand the language, and especially when they lose a loved one, an elder. That elder says, I want to go through the ceremonies when I die. I want to go the old way. So we take care of them in the old way, and then the younger generation gets up and says, why can't I do this? Why can't I speak my language? Why can't I sing these songs? They're lost.
That story was produced by KPLU's Matthew Stribe. Russell Jim says that the Yakima parents still send their kids to Indian boarding schools, often for financial reasons. Jim, however, is raising two of his grandchildren at home. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestedt. KPLU's Matthew Stribe and Jennifer Wing contributed this week. We had help from intern Bree Ripley. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy, and we had web help from Mike Lewis. Our podcast is available for free on iTunes. You can subscribe to it there and make our week by leaving us a short review. You can also send feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org. or tweet at KPLU and at Gabriel Spitzer. Truly, we really do want to hear what you think of the show. We can take it. Join us here next week when we'll bring you Sound Effect as seen on TV.
There you are.
Oh my God, is that how I walk?
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.